everyone. Welcome to Baird's IPO Reboot Series, where executives can learn the ABCs of going public. I'm Tom Shadwell. I'm a director on Baird's Equity Capital Markets Desk based in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. In today's episode number 5, we will be discussing building a public-ready financial model. I'm delighted to be joined today by Greg McDowell from ICR. Greg, I'll hand it over to you to quickly introduce yourself and give viewers a quick overview of your background.
Yeah, great, Tom. Thanks so much for having me. My name is Greg McDowell. I run the tech group at ICR. I've spent my whole 25-year career in and around the software sector. So 10 years at Oracle, then 10 years as a sell-side equity research analyst covering the software sector. And for the last 4.5 years, I've been at ICR. And ICR has been a part of many IPOs, obviously before the IPO tech market shut down, but you know, whether it's Hashi or Braze or Zoom Video or Procore, we've been involved in some of the biggest and best software IPOs in the last 5 years.
That's great, Greg. And I think given the breadth of your experience, different roles historically, I think you're the perfect guest to have on for today's topic. So maybe just to start here and level set kind of the conversation, what do you view as the role of the financial model in the IPO process? Why is it so important?
Yeah, great question, Tom. I mean, the financial model of your business, right, is one of the foundational elements, not only of your of a company's IPO process, but also life as a public company, right? I mean, the past performance of a company is reflected in the financial statements, and the financial projections in a financial model really tell the story to Wall Street of how you should be viewed as a business. So, you know, when a company is embarking on that IPO process, you know, a buy-side investor, right, your future shareholders, a public equity investor, is really going to use the model to determine whether or not, you know, you check their box, right? And maybe, you know, that box has to do with the scale of your business, you know, the growth rate of your business, or your profitability profile. So, you know, the narrative of your entire equity story is really anchored in the financial model, right? And maybe given my analyst background, I'm over-indexing a little bit on the model a little bit, but you know, people quickly want to determine, right? Are you a 50% grower, but your growth rate is slowing to 20%? Or maybe you're a 40% grower, but you can sustain sort of 30% plus growth for a long time. So that durable growth narrative. Or maybe you're a 10% grower, and that's okay because you have 30% margins. So at the end of the day, you know, the financial model just reveals so much about your business and how your business should be viewed.
And maybe just in terms of all these IPO kind of processes can kind of be daunting to start with. Yeah. If you're the CFO, where would you recommend the CFO and their finance teams kind of start from a financial modeling perspective?
Yeah, well, and I love your word choice because it is indeed such a daunting and arduous process. I mean, I really break it down to three things, right? It's the right team, the right systems in place, and the right processes in place. Obviously, as a company is embarking on an IPO, like they really have to look around, determine if they have the right team that's IPO ready, public ready. Obviously, you know, the model process is such a key part of that process that they're perhaps are often really, really important hires that a company needs to make. So that's team. When it comes to systems, I mean, this is really obvious, right? But you should have some of the right accounting systems in place to run your business. You should have the right budgeting and planning software systems to be able to really forecast the business. Obviously, Salesforce automation system, so a way to really track the business and forecast bookings and revenue is critical. And finally, obviously, you know, you have to have the right processes in place, right? This means, you know, closing the books quickly, right? Having your different business divisions being able to roll up forecasts to the CFO so the CFO can translate that into the forecasting of the totality of the business and the financial model.
Maybe just to put a finer lens on one of those points you made around the right team, who all is typically involved in building the model, the KPIs, the forecasts?
Yeah, it is a team sport, right? I mean, a financial model, right? It truly is a multidisciplinary process, right? And it does involve absolutely every single part of the organization. But specific to an IPO process, we generally view the CFO as the team captain and the quarterback of the model in an IPO process. Usually it's someone on the CFO's team that's, you know, the true keeper of the model, both the internal model and the external model. Also in an IPO process, you know, there's going to be a lot of outside parties involved in the model and the buildup of the model. Right, your IPO advisors, your banking partners, your auditors, your internal counsel and outside external counsel. So there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen when it comes to the model, which makes it even more important to really run a really super disciplined process when it comes to the financial model.
Those are great points, Greg. And maybe like shifting gears a little bit, I love to leave our viewers with just practical takeaways. So in your experience, what's one of the hardest concepts for companies to grasp when it comes to this IPO modeling process?
Yeah, I think one of the hardest concepts to grasp is this idea that there's going to be multiple models out there a public company has to really calibrate themselves to this idea that not that you're keeping different sets of books necessarily, but that the way you manage the business internally is not necessarily the external view of the business. And so when you're a private company, right, it's really, really easy to, you know, you have your internal model, your forecast, this is what gets shared with your board. Right? Maybe you have your base case, what you think you're really going to do. You have your upside case and your downside case. And it's pretty simple, right? As a private company. But once you embark on sort of the IPO process, right, the number of models just multiplies, right? So just to give you a few examples, right? You have a banker model. Eventually you're going to have to choose your banking partners and you're going to have to share a forecast with the investment banks. And if you want a realistic view of the valuation of your business from a public markets perspective, right, the banks need to analyze your forecast, right? When you get much later in the IPO process, right, so after you've chosen your banking partners like Baird and you have this syndicate formed, and it's usually a team of banking partners, right, you start to work with their research analysts, right? This is the sell side, right? These are the publishing equity research analysts. And you're going to share a model with those research analysts. And, you know, that model isn't the same as your internal model, right? Because you need to build cushion in the model and you need to play the beat and raise game. And so it quickly gets very, very complicated because you have your internal model with different cases, then you have the model you share with the street, then the research analysts all come back with their views of the model. And then to make it even more complicated, you have the buy side and you have their model, right? That's where you hear concepts like what's the bogey or what's the whisper number, like what's the real growth rate? Because maybe I don't believe the research analysts in their models because I know there's cushion in the model. So anyway, it's that's the to get to the heart of your question, that's the hardest part is finance teams and executive teams, they really have to learn that there's different models floating out there and they have to make sure, whether it's their internal audience or external audience, they have to talk about the model differently depending on the audience.
Yeah, and so you mentioned beat and raise, that kind of encompasses the concept you're talking about there. Maybe expand on that a little bit more.
Yeah, sure. I mean, beat and raise, you know,
it is really a public company kind of concept, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's been a part of Wall Street for a long, long time, right? It's even more pronounced in tech investing. You know, some people love it, some people hate it. And you know, maybe it'd be a better world if it didn't exist. But as it stands today, tech stocks generally move higher when numbers are going up, and tech stocks tend to suffer when estimates are moving down. And so generally the only way estimates are going to move up is if companies, right, put a lot of care and feeding into the beat and raise model and play the game and establish a good cadence. And so it's just something you got to do. And the companies with the highest valuations tend to play the game and play well.
Yeah, I think people underestimate like the momentum and public stocks. It's definitely a little bit different. It can work both to the upside and the downside. And so I feel like there's a cautionary element of this too. Like what are the impacts of not playing or not participating kind of beat and raise mentality correctly?
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head, right? And we're seeing this play out in real time in tech investing, in the sense that there's this huge spread in valuations of publicly traded tech companies, right? And you know, I'll just use software as an example, because that's the world I spend most of my time is in. You know, the whole software group, right? If you looked at the whole SaaS group, you know, they're roughly trading at, you know, 5 to 6 times EV to forward revenue. But you have this huge range, right? You have this elite club of software companies trading, you know, over 10 times revenue. Some, like a Snowflake, trading even closer to 20 times revenue. And then you have this class of companies trading, you know, around 1 to 2 times revenue, right? And that's a huge difference in valuations. And usually when you see a company, right, trading closer to 1 times revenue, something has happened, right? And you can usually link that valuation to one of two things, right? Either the business just hasn't performed, right? And that could be due to macro, it could be due to product market fit, or right, something got tripped up during the beat and raise process. Usually it's in the form of not building enough cushion into the beat and raise model. Or sometimes it's a combination of both those things. So, you know, it's just important to play the beat and raise game correctly.
Yeah, and it's always like, if you get put in the penalty box, there can be a bunch of different factors. And so I think the recommendation is like, don't make this one of the factors to get in that penalty box to begin with, because it can be hard to get out of.
There you go. Well said, Tom.
And so, like, from a financial information perspective, what are like the key things that the research analysts and investors are going to be focused on? I know it can be industry specific, so maybe you can talk through it through the lens of software.
Yeah, sure. I mean, KPIs are just so critical, right? When it comes to software investing, I'll use software just because I'm most familiar with it. Right, because right, the financial statements don't always tell the whole story of what's going on inside a software company. So you almost need to supplement the financial statements with key KPIs. And so, you know, for a SaaS company, right, it can get really confusing, because, you know, a company could beat on revenue, but actually they've missed their internal bookings by a mile because not enough reps hit their quota for the quarter, right? And that has to do with some of the accounting that has to do with in SaaS, where you're amortizing revenue over time. So, you know, a company really has to get comfortable with KPIs and what other parts of the income statements are showing. And so when we're working with private companies, you know, we focus a lot with things that show like the true intrinsic growth of the business, right? So these could be things like ARR, right? Not all companies disclose ARR, but a lot of companies do. And in the absence of disclosing ARR, investors and analysts are really going to focus on things like deferred revenue, which you get up from the balance sheet. They're really going to focus on something called RPO, or remaining performance obligations. and they're going to look for patterns, right? They're going to look for, you know, what was the sequential change in deferred revenue from quarter to quarter? What was the sequential change in RPO from quarter to quarter? To make it even more fun, right? They're going to look at like current deferred versus long-term deferred, or current RPO versus long-term RPO. And so the end result, right? You know, you get to these proxies, a billings proxy, an RPO bookings proxy, and you could have very, very different growth rates of the business. And so it's just really critical for companies to understand, you know, what's going on, you know, from that revenue perspective and all the indicators. Certainly, there's KPIs that are really important, like net dollar retention rates, customer counts. Certainly in this macro environment, we're seeing a lot more prominence of unit economics, right? What's your LTV to CAC, right? What's your payback period? And so really, when it comes to KPIs, just companies really need to intimately understand their own KPIs. They need to forecast their IPO, their KPIs ahead of the IPO, just so they're ready if, right? Like, we're seeing a lot of net dollar retention come down, right, in this macro. So you just really need to understand it and be sharp on KPIs.
Yeah, and I think you had a nuanced point in there too. Given you're shifting to this quarterly reporting kind of aspect, like, mm-hmm. obviously certain KPIs are going to work better on a quarterly or a yearly, yeah. Or further out long-term basis. Like, how do companies think about that?
Yeah, no, it's a great point, because you know, sometimes companies are very comfortable sharing something every quarter, but sometimes you know, you only want to give something once a year, and that's okay. Sometimes you may only want to give something once, right, pre-IPO, as you're still a private company, because you know you're public. When you're public, you're not going to share it again. But you want those research analysts on the syndicate to really understand the company. And so, you know, you are allowed, you know, you have a little latitude in terms of with one-time disclosure. And, you know, as you know, once you're public and you get in a cadence of doing an analyst day, you know, once a year or once every 2 years, right, you can introduce new KPIs. So there's nothing that says KPIs are absolutely set in stone. They can evolve. But it's not just about the KPIs, right? It's also about the frequency of disclosure of those KPIs.
Yeah, I think that's critically important for folks to know that it's not, you can use different KPIs on different kind of frequency. And so maybe along kind of similar topic, obviously as humans, we love to put things in, like categorize things in our brains. Obviously, yeah. Every company is going to be slightly different in terms of how it's actually making money. So how wedded from your experience the company to those existing KPIs out there used by public companies that have been public for a long time in their industry? And if you're a new sector, kind of the public markets, how can a company go about defining kind of what those new KPIs are going to be for their industry?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair question. Not all companies always like my answer, because I do think companies are fairly wedded to some of the existing KPIs that are out there, right? So if you have competitors that are already public and 100% of those competitors are sharing a certain metric, it would look really strange for you as a company to go public and not share that metric, right? It would look like you're trying to hide something. But if you do something differently, right? If you're in a different sector, if you attack the market a little bit differently, by all means, like, we encourage companies to go ahead and share it. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, companies are, you know, in an IPO process, companies are educating the market on their story. So anything a company to do to more effectively communicate with current shareholders and prospective shareholders is okay, right? I mean, that's literally a CEO's, CFO's most important job, in my view, is being an effective communicator of how the business really, really works. And so, you know, we do see some companies really reticent to share lots of KPIs. They get nervous about it, right? And I mean, I think our view is generally transparency wins at the end of the day, right? The pendulum has certainly swung back to investors in this environment, right? And so public companies have to remember they're competing for dollars, right, from the buy side. And if an investor gets frustrated because KPI disclosure is poor, they're just going to throw their hands up and move on to another story. Because as you know, to my earlier point, there's a plethora. I think I last counted that there's like 50 publicly traded companies trading at less than 4x revenue. So they're just going to move on to the next one if they're not satisfied with your KPI disclosure. So don't be afraid to be bold. I think that's my whole message here.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point for people to understand. It's like public market investors very much scrutinize the numbers, the earlier points you've made, and you're not going to sneak anything past very smart crowd of folks. So it's better to overdisclose, but then to make sure that you can communicate appropriately moving forward. Right. And just over communicate. People just want to understand. Yeah. And so we're talking a lot about KPIs. But another thing you hear a lot about is like non-GAAP metrics. And so what adjustments from your experience do investors typically find acceptable when moving from GAAP to non-GAAP metrics for things like adjusted EBITDA, for example?
Yeah. I mean, how many hours do you have, Tom? I mean, this could be a spirited debate. Look, I mean, regardless of where you fall philosophically on GAAP to non-GAAP, you know, adjustments are made in the tech landscape. I'd say the most common adjustment is stock-based compensation, right? There's also very common adjustments like, depreciation, amortization, you know, sometimes legal expenses, right? Lately, with all the headcount reductions we're seeing in the tech sector, you're seeing a lot of restructuring adjustments between GAAP and non-GAAP. I think the view is, in general, these are all very acceptable adjustments. Certainly the most controversial one as of late is stock-based comp, right? And, we talk to companies about, you're going to be viewed against others. Like you could look at stock-based comp as a percentage of revenue. If you're way out of whack with your peer group, that's when people are going to really, really dig in more. Because, you know, if it's really, really high for investors, it just means future dilution down the road. So, for the most part, you just need to be careful. You need to make sure you're not standing out too much. It's not one size fits all for every company, but in general, right, if you're trying to do something unnatural, right, I won't name the company, but there was an example years ago of, you know, community adjusted EBITDA, and, you know, people do not look kindly to, you know, adjusting out real expenses in the business to make you look like you have a better EBITDA or non-GAAP operating income.
Yeah, and I think reality is that some of the stuff we've been talking about for the last few minutes is you want to be reporting what this comes down to like the street, or as you said, the buy side model, right? You want to be reporting what people are actually going to use, ultimately the value of your business. So the more you can figure that out as part of your IPO process, I think the better off you're going to be in the long run.
Absolutely. That's right.
And so maybe like recent trends, is there anything you're seeing investors, and I touched on a few points, requesting more frequently they haven't wanted historically? Are there any new metrics that companies are kind of coming out and just starting to report to help people better understand their businesses?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, look, a research analyst or investor that's not continuously asking for more metrics is not really doing their job, right? And so specific to SaaS, like it's always evolving in this economic environment. Certainly people are asking for more, right? They want more of a disaggregation of the business, especially if you're selling different products, different lines. So this could be things like, you know, enterprise versus SMB, give me more detail on those two things, or it could be something like you know, business versus consumer, right? If you have two elements of your business, it could be something as like drawing a line of your customer base. So like how many customers do you have paying more than 100K in ARR a year, right? So people really want to understand sort of, your big customer behavior versus small customer behavior. Certainly things like gross margin segmentation, if you have different business lines with different gross margin profiles. And really in the last year, I'd say that the biggest trend I've seen is this idea of medium-term targets, right? So remember, like a company on public earnings calls is usually guiding to, you know, the quarter and the year. And then they have this long-term model slide, which is usually, you know, 3, 4, 5 years out, right? And so as the path to profitability has become more and more important, companies are really putting in medium-term targets. So like, when can they flip positive on an EBITDA basis, even if it's, you know, early in 2024 or late in 2024, because investors are insisting on knowing like, when is that crossover point to profitability? So that's become really important. And I'd say the last one is when it comes to, you know, dollar-based net retention rate, people really want to understand sort of the underlying behavior of that, like what's happening to upsell, what's happening to downsell, right? In seat-based models, software models, downsell is really, really important, right? You go from 100 seats to 80 seats, like that's a headwind to revenue. Churn is really important. So it evolves, Tom. People are asking for more. I think a lot of what they're asking for is relatively fair, but you every company has to spend a lot of time thinking about the positives and negatives of sharing more KPIs and metrics.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know we've covered a lot today. And so maybe we'll wrap it up with one final question here. I like to ask all my guests at kind of end of each episode, and your response doesn't need to be limited just to today's topic. But what are, in your view, what are the three most important pieces of advice that you would give a company that's thinking about going public?
Yeah, I mean, three pieces of advice I'd give to a company embarking on this journey to the public markets. I mean, the first one, and maybe it sounds a little self-serving, but it's to start early, right? I mean, we touched on it earlier. It's a very arduous process to get to the public markets. It truly does take a village in terms of partners and everyone you need to involve. Start early, because when the tech IPO markets do reopen, your buyers, it's going to be a much more discerning buyer base. And so it's actually really easy to sniff out when a company has started late their IPO process, because it feels like a rush job, a jam job. And so starting early is going to serve you well in terms of being a public company. So that's number one. I'd say number two is, you know, companies should start to act and think like a public company now, right? So our conversation earlier on maintaining multiple models, maintaining a beat and race cadence, you can start doing that now as a private company, and you can run mock earnings calls where the only audience is maybe your board, right? You could run these earnings simulations, or you can do a quarterly investor letter that's just for internal consumption, but pretend it's for external consumption as if you were a public company. And going through the Q&A. So like practicing Q&A as if you were doing a real earnings call, right? Go through the prep process of doing that. So that's number two. And lastly, stay engaged with Wall Street, right? I we see a lot of companies right now, there's this temptation to just batten down the hatches, right? Crawl into a hole, say you're focused on the business, and sort of block out that engagement plan with Wall Street. But things can change really, really quickly. And, you know, companies that keep talking to public equity investors, the buy side, and keep talking to the banks and the banks' research analysts, that's going to allow them to keep the pulse of the market. And really, when you pull investors, when you pull the buy side, they usually want to see you 3, 4, 5 times even before you go public. Like the worst scenario is the first time a company or a buy sider meets you is on that IPO roadshow. So, you know, on to end on a positive note, right? Tech IPO markets can't stay closed forever. They will come back, right? I'm increasingly hopeful about the state of the equity capital markets. I mean, look at the VIX, look at some of the things happening right now. So anyway, those are my three pieces of advice.
And that's an excellent point that I think people probably overly handicap is it is really a relationship business. You're building a very long-term, if not decade plus relationship with the investors that invest in your stock as a public company. And so it doesn't hurt to engage early and often and just build that relationship before you press go on the IPO. So
that's right.
I would like to say thanks to Greg. Thanks to the viewers. I'm sure your insights, Greg, have been very valuable for everyone tuning in to this episode. If you would like to get a hold of either Greg or I, you can find our contact information on our respective companies' websites. So thanks again to Greg and to our viewers.
Thanks so much, Tom. I really enjoyed being here.